10.
Mm-hmm. Reason for celebration.
It's a reason for celebration. This is our 10th episode. Congratulations, Dave.
Yeah. This is I'm going to dedicate this to all our friends who use base 10 number systems.
Let's see. So I'm doing a little calculation here, Dave. That represents 30 hours of our lives that we've devoted to this thing.
Yes. In addition to all the other people who have listened, and we thank them for doing that.
Yes, that's right. That's right. And where we can, we thank them individually. So what do you say, Dave? Let's get started.
Yeah. What's on tap?
Well, we got the huge news, the open data policy. So the federal government just released a new open data policy, which is extremely great. Dave, you've got an update for us on Scratch, probably the most approachable programming environment we've seen. Open source network hardware, declassification of both the intentional and unintentional variety. We get the Red Hat supports Panopticon. Let's see here.
Which is not the word of the week.
Which is not the word of the week. DoD using OpenShift, which is super exciting. We're really pumped about this. My beloved Markdown and year zero of our meeting jihad.
Yes. That's awesome. That's awesome.
So, Dave, if folks want to learn more about the show, maybe listen to some of our episodes, maybe get links to some of the stuff we're going to talk about, where do they go for that?
Yeah, they want to go to dgshow.org. So it's D's and Dave, G's and Gunner, show.org. And we're on iTunes. And we also have, don't forget to go to where we give thanks to the people who provided us content for this week. And we also have some things on our cutting room floor. So what are some of those things, Gunner?
Oh, we got the Onion teaches everyone how to get hacked like a gentleman. And we got a link to this hilarious proprietary patented innovation award for the Army and the Navy, which is total Gunner bait. An incredible atrocity. But anyway, what do you say? You want to get started?
Yeah. So I know that the federal government, they have a federal open data policy that they released, and I'm sure you were all excited about it.
Yeah, super excited about it. Yeah. And it was my Twitter sprung alive when this came out. The open data policy directs the agencies on not only the principles of open data and why government data should be more available to people, but make some specific recommendations on what open data means and how agencies should make data more open. So crucially, they talk about making it machine readable, which makes sense. There have been criticisms of open data or transparency efforts in the past where they will post a bunch of PDFs or worse, scans of Word documents that get posted as PDFs, which are, you know, you have to use OCR software to go understand what it is, and it's not easily consumable by programs, right? People who want to do data analysis. Anyway, the open data policy tells agencies that this stuff has to be machine readable, right? So it has to be in XML or some like well understood file format. So that's already huge. And also, something which is great for the open source crowd is all this open data has to be under an open license. While a lot of federal data is certainly under public domain, because the federal government can't use copyrights, data that was generated by contractors to the government may in fact be copyrighted. And so this says explicitly, this data has to be under an open license. So something like a Creative Commons, like CC0 type license. Super exciting stuff. We got a link to that new policy in the show notes.
Yeah. Well, and actually, Gunner, maybe we can call an audible real quick and go down to talk about the speaking of releasing documents. What if we talk about the declassification engine a little bit?
Oh yeah, this is a really cool product. And so this is our friend John Scott turned us on to this, right?
Go ahead.
Oh, well, so this is a graduate program, right, Dave?
Yeah, it's a project, and it's almost like this Kickstarter some grad students are trying to raise $50,000 to help accelerate the declassification of data, because it seems like there's warehouses and warehouses of data that ends up being destroyed, and these are significant pieces of history, but they're being destroyed because it takes too long to declassify them, and it's very, very expensive to do. So what they're working on are tools to be able to do the declassification.
in an rapidly. Automated way. So mm-hmm. so being able to look at so being able to scan a classified document and say these are the words, or this is kind of what a classified document looks like, or and this is what an unclassified document looks like, and based on that data, seeing a third document and saying, oh, okay, well, this looks like the unclassified document, so chances are pretty good that this can be unclassified as well.
Yeah.
So, like, automating the process. Really interesting work. It sounds, frankly, like magic, and a bargain at $50,000 if these guys pull it off, so that's very cool. And there's another way of declassifying stuff too, right, Dave?
Oh, my gosh. Yeah,
disaster.
Yeah. It's in a chill through my spine when I saw this. So there was a Wired article that talked about NSA releasing a book that they declassified on how to become your own. Well, essentially, it shows you how to become your own spy agency. And they put some things in there in the Wired article. I don't want to even say it out loud. but you could go to the Wired article, check it out, do some sample searches. And Gunnar, I told you to type in a couple things, and you typed it into Google. And what was your reaction?
It's horrifying. So the idea is that you can use basic Google search terms and be able to uncover data which has been inadvertently posted to the public internet that really shouldn't have been posted to the public internet. Again, won't use the words here. Some of them will be in the show notes. You should definitely go read the article, and you will be shocked and appalled at the kind of data you can find using these terms.
Oh my gosh.
They're really embarrassing. Yeah.
Yep.
Terrible. On a lighter note, I understand you have some guinea pig news.
Yes. So there are two big events that are on my daughter's calendar for this month. One is the new Star Trek movie that's coming out. And
so
she's
excited about that.
Oh, she's pumped about it. And then the second thing is she's like, oh, man, the Scratch website is down. They're getting ready for Scratch 2.0. And it's like, oh. And so she's like all excited. And so Scratch 2.0 came out. And you'd think that it's like, well, okay, it's 2.0, and what's a big deal? But the really interesting thing that I found is that the user interface, instead of you downloading the software and installing it, it's all web-based. So you could go to my daughter's guinea pig game. Not only can you play it in right on your web browser, but you could actually click a button and see the program that she wrote and be able to fork it and modify it and save it to your own area. So I thought it was just really, really fascinating. And it also uses what they call cloud data for integration. So things like storing high scores and things like that. It's just really, really cool.
That idea of having it be literally be open by default, right? To be able to look at someone's code, to be able to see how the game works and then see the mechanics of it. Really exciting and a huge learning tool. I mean, you know, one of the reasons people say the web became so popular is because you could go to a web page and then say view source and mm-hmm. see how someone built it, right? I know that's how I learned HTML.
Yes.
And so this is basically the same thing for some fairly sophisticated gaming engine. Really cool. It's great work.
Yeah. Well, speaking of that, there's a thing called a backpack where it's like you see a sprite that you like. So like Gunnar, before we started, I sent you the link to Lauren's guinea pig game, and mm-hmm. and not only were, you know, in the past you could play it, I showed you, you could click a button, you could look at the code. So what you could do is you could actually take her guinea pig, if you like it, and put it in what's called your backpack. And so you could basically take her sprite out of her program and then put it in your backpack and then use that in your own programs as well. So again, it's that culture of sharing and being able to reuse code. It's just really, really cool.
That's great. And built right into the tool. That's great.
But I have some concerns, though.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. So Scratch 2.0 is it's web-based, which is awesome, but it's based on Flash.
Boo!
Yeah. And you know why? Not only is it, you know, all the problems with Flash and security and stability and stuff like that, but you know why my heart aches? Because
heart
it's Flash-based?
Yeah, my heart is now aching in sympathy. What could be worse than just being in Flash in the first place?
Raspberry Pi.
Right.
Is there a Flash player for Raspberry Pi?
Not that I'm aware of.
No. There's no ARM-based Flash player. Thank goodness. But that means that, you know, one of the big selling points for the Raspberry Pi was being able to get kids up and running and using code and writing code and all that, and being able to have their own little personal computer that they could write code on was really exciting. So now, as of right now, there's no way that you could download Scratch and be able to 2.0 and install it on your computer and run it. They do have plans to do an offline version, so hopefully they'll still have the ARM port for Raspberry Pi and all that. And I hope that comes out. I know that they've been GPL, so I hope they'll be doing the right thing. But I'm still excited about Scratch 2.0 being out, and my daughter's really excited about it too.
Oh, that's great. Well, maybe Lauren on the Raspberry Pi will have to content herself with using a logo. Right, there's got to be a logo port to Raspberry Pi, right?
Yeah, well, the other thing is that she's there's Pi Game, which is it's a gaming library for Python. So that's one of the other things that comes with the Raspberry Pi. So now that when I talked to her, she's like, "Well, now that I got the programming concepts figured out visually, and I know what an if loop is an if then statement or a while loop." Now she can extend that to higher level languages and more complicated things like Python.
Oh, that's fantastic. That's fantastic. Yeah. Yep. Get around to Python as soon as possible. We need some more Python coders. That's great. So speaking of code and source code, and then previously talking about security, there was the new Coverity stand came out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what is Coverity, Gunnar?
So Coverity is a company that builds... Their tool allows you to scan through code, source code, and look for kind of common flaws. So these are things like buffer overflows. You get the idea. And so I think back in 2006, Coverity got together with DHS, with Homeland Security, and they started using Coverity's tools on popular open source projects. And the idea here is that they would periodically scan the projects for common flaws and then open up bugs for the projects so they could go fix them, which is mm-hmm. fantastic. Even more useful is they take the open source results and compare them each year with proprietary code. And so it's been a nice, we now get this, let's call it longitudinal study from 2006 to now to see how proprietary code has changed or how open source code has changed and how that has affected the security. So what were some of the results, Dave?
Well, I thought that there were two big things that came out. Number one is that the title of a lot of the articles is that Linux is still the benchmark of quality. So whether it's proprietary code or open source code, the Linux kernel project seems to be running a very well-run ship. So that's pretty cool. The other thing that I noticed too is that they did a lot of comparisons between, like you said, the open source projects that are out there, as well as they had people that submitted their proprietary code of various sizes and ages as well. And from a comparison standpoint, and they found that the proprietary code and the open source code, they would like leapfrog each other based upon how big the projects were, or how many lines of code were in each project. So there was almost like a wash. There was no real clear winner there.
Right, right. There was also part of the results was there's some threshold, right? What was it, a million lines of code? If something goes over a million lines of code, was it open source projects don't necessarily do as well as proprietary projects? Was that right?
Yeah, and I wonder too if that's just a statistical thing, or if the sample size was big enough, or the number of projects were big enough. But I'd hate to make generalizations. But one of the overall trends that they've seen though is whether it is proprietary codes or open source codes, the quality is actually getting better year over year.
Yeah, that's right. Well, and I remember reading in the there was some article. This headline is open source breaks after a million lines of code, which if you look at the statistics in the study, the actual difference in defect densities was the difference between, like, I think 0.62 and 0.64 per 1,000 lines of code, something like that. So not as great a difference as some muckraking journalists would like us to think.
Right. And I'm sure it all depends on what point in time that somebody checks something in. And yeah, exactly.
Cool.
Yep. Yeah, and then there's also one of the articles that I saw is any article that talks about rattling something, where I found that to be humorous, where this article was, this again was from Wired, where Facebook rattles the networking world with open source gear.
That's great. I get this great image of all these Cisco engineers running screaming from the building, right?
Yes.
Now terrified of Facebook, right?
Yeah, hiding under things, yeah.
Right. So now this is part of the Open Compute Project.
Yeah, Facebook, what, right? What's that?
So Facebook is a huge consumer of hardware, and what they realized is that instead of buying hardware off the shelf, it's actually more efficient for them to create specialized hardware that works well in their environment, right? So that might be rearranging components on a motherboard. It might be taking all the screws out of a chassis. And they found it was more efficient for both their data center and their operations to procure this kind of custom hardware from the ODMs, the original design manufacturers. You know, most of them are in Taiwan, rather than going through your typical OEM like IBM or HP or Dell. Mm-hmm. So that would be an interesting story in and of itself, but what the OCP is what Facebook open sourced the designs that they created, right? So they have servers that they've built to run efficiently on a Facebook scale data center, and they've taken those designs and released them to the world, and their intent is to create an ecosystem around this hardware so that they can compete maintenance on this hardware, right? So instead of buying IBM gear and paying the IBM maintenance on the gear each year, Facebook would be able to purchase these open designs from an ODM or from a white box manufacturer, and then each year compete the maintenance on it. Really ingenious, really disruptive, right? It kind of completes the commoditization of the hardware market, and they've just expanded into networking now.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So what did they do with the networking?
I will read you a passage from the article here. It says, the idea is to design a networking switch that anyone can load with their own operating system, just as you can load your own OS on a computer server. This is the Linux disruption, right? Where you come in and you put the operating software, you put a certain piece of operating software on there. Traditionally, that has been tied to a particular piece of hardware. If you're running Cisco gear, you're running Cisco's operating system. These guys are pulling the two things apart, again, to increase choice, increase freedom, and commoditize the gear.
Yeah, and I think they're being smart about it too, where you look at other companies that are of a similar scale, and they keep a lot of their hardware designs to themselves, where I think Facebook is doing it right in terms of making it open, because their secret sauce is not, just like Netflix and those other guys, is their secret sauce is not in the hardware design, it's in the other things that are of added value. So if they can commoditize those components that they don't see are strategic, that helps them save a lot of money by increasing the addressable market instead of them being the ones bearing the burden of the engineering cost.
That's right. And we'd be remiss if we didn't say that Red Hat happens to sell a product which does something very similar to the storage market, right?
Yep. Yeah, so what we're talking about here is the big thing with software-defined networking, and you could actually abstract that to a software-defined data center, where what we have at Red Hat is we have software-defined storage, which is Red Hat storage, which instead of buying a particular piece of hardware that is running a particular operating system and it's all in one box, with Red Hat storage, you could run it on any white box computer or in a virtual machine or up in the cloud. And so, again, you can compete the hardware that or the virtualization or the cloud providers and run it wherever you want to be able to do your storage.
It's great. It's great. Over the long term, open just has to eat everything, right?
Yeah, looks like it.
It looks like it. So, Dave, what are you doing next week?
Yeah, so I had that Beyond the Bits webinar and it got postponed the other week, and so we're actually doing it for real this time next week Thursday, fingers crossed. Well, which I guess when this launches, it'll be this week Thursday, right?
Right, that's right. Yeah.
So to be specific, that'll be Thursday the 16th.
Oh, great. Okay, well, while you're doing that, I will be in Albany with our friends at Accenture, talking about a really cool SOA platform that they've developed for public sector And so come on, check that out. And actually the day before, Wednesday, which is tomorrow, based on when we post this, tomorrow the 15th, I will be in Dallas talking about platform as a service and OpenShift. And yeah, so come on out.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, cool. So Dave, you just learned about this new tool at Red Hat. We're like lousy with new tools at Red Hat support all of a sudden, right? Like last show we talked about the live chat and everything, but this one's a big deal, right? This is pretty cool.
Yeah. Well, what's interesting is that we praised the Red Hat support people and they retweeted us, and then I think a lot of the support people got our podcast in their crosshairs, and they're like, "Well, hey, you forgot to tell us about this and this and this," you know. And so it was pretty cool. Chris Williams, who's in our support organization, he said, "Oh yeah, you forgot to. I don't know if you know about this, but we actually do screen sharing."
Cool.
Which it's sort of like I would always think that would be sort of like the go-to support sort of thing that is that the computer technician would be talking to my parents to get their computer fixed and stuff like that, but. Chris said that we actually have had a lot of public sector customers that are taking advantage of it. And so I think, you know, and the way he told me was that one of the big things that our support organization tries to do is tighten that iteration loop. So remember how I said last time about how I encourage people to, you know, pick the phone up and talk to us instead of doing the whole, you know, the high latency email back and forth. Mm-hmm. And, by doing the screen sharing over the phone, not only will once you get the screen sharing going, it will record the session and then keep it inside the case ticket, so the customer can play it back later, and so can support people. So I thought that was pretty interesting.
That's really cool. That's really cool. Yeah. Especially for, I guess, for UI problems, right? That's got to be extremely handy.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah, and I was surprised. He gave me a list of customers that are using it, and I was like, wow, it's pretty extensive.
That's awesome.
So check it out. Ask for it by name. Tell them that Dave and Gunner sent you.
That's right. Let's see. What else is going on? Oh, yeah, we had our friend Dan Jungst from the Cloud BU, the Cloud Business Unit. He was at the FedScoop Tech Shootout this week, right? I was reading the. I wasn't able to attend, but I saw in the article the coverage of it. They picked one phrase out that Dan had dropped on the audience, and what was that phrase, Dave?
Go ugly early,
which cracks me up every time. I love it. Go ugly early as a more meaty, more robust version of fail faster. Which fail faster is a little bit delicate, a little bit French. Go ugly early. It's nice and German. It's short words. It's good.
Well, the first time I heard go ugly early, I thought that would be something you would overhear at a college bar.
That's right.
But yeah, what do I know? So we also have a customer that we like a lot this week, don't we?
Oh, we love this customer. We are huge fans of this customer.
So this is Disa.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So Disa, this week, you've heard us talk in the past about OpenShift. In fact, I think we've successfully mentioned it in every episode so far. So
there was one where we didn't.
But we missed one. Okay.
We apologized in the next one. Yeah,
that's right. So Disa Stacks is a so first of all, Disa is it's kind of complicated, but Disa is basically the IT department for the DoD. Is that a fair way to put it? Kind of a shared services organization for DoD. So Disa, who already has this infrastructure as a service stood up, they call it RACE, they realized that they needed to make it easier for warfighters, for developers to quickly stand up development environments in a secure manner, right? Obviously, it's Disa, it's the DoD, they're worried about security. So they had started doing this on their own, and then they heard about OpenShift, and instead they have taken a 90-degree turn, and Disa Stacks has adopted OpenShift as their platform. So if you are in the military and you are on NIPR or CIPR networks, you can jump onto DizzyStax and start using our OpenShift Enterprise product. If you want to hear more about that, I did an interview with our good friend Gordon Half, a.k.a. BitMason, and we'll include a link to that that podcast in the show notes. I am super excited about this, Dave. I am telling everyone who will listen.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, so cool.
Yeah.
Let's see. What else we got here, Dave? Oh, Markdown. So, Dave, you know I love Markdown.
Yes.
I use it for everything.
Can't live without it.
I cannot live without it. I use it for my meeting notes. I send emails written in Markdown. I use it for my blog posts. So I got super excited because I learned that Dropbox, extremely useful service, which we've discussed before, if I want to share a file in Dropbox, right, I just go to the file and I share the link and I have a link and I paste it in an email and that person can go download the ISO or the MP3 or whatever it is. It turns out that if you share a link to a Markdown document, Dropbox will not show the person the ugly plain text Markdown document. They will show the visitor a beautifully rendered HTML document, which is so handy. Anyway, I'm excited about this. If you are excited about Markdown like I am, go in the show notes. I have a link to an example. It's great stuff. The more I use Markdown, the more I love it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, one thing I wonder, though, and I haven't got into it myself yet, and I need to try it, is I worry that I would be spending too much time on the setup than I would in time savings.
That's true. That's true. You always have to make sure you're not yak shaving, right?
Yes.
But for the amount of time that Markdown saves me, being able to actually the fact that I can use the same format in all these different modes, right? Whether it's taking meeting notes, doing the show notes for this week, mm-hmm. Doing blog posts, I can easily take content from the show notes as an example and paste them into my blogging platform, and everything kind of understands it, right? Mm-hmm. It's that lingua franca, which is the aspect that I like. And there's a great tool called Pandoc, which can actually convert, as an example, Markdown into an open document format, right? So I can create a quote unquote Word document out of Markdown. So Markdown is super cool, Dave. If you haven't checked it out, you gotta.
Yeah, I need to do that.
So Dave, you got a word for the week, right?
Yep. Yep. Yeah, skeuomorphism.
Yeah. It sounds like a condition.
Yeah. Yeah. You need a prescription for that. Yeah. So skeuomorphism, I saw an article about that, and we'll put that in the show notes, which a skeuomorph is a physical ornament or design on an object made to resemble another material or technique. So if you could think about like a simulated wood grain on a car, which there's no wood there, but it's actually a sticker. Mm-hmm. That's one example. Or and one of the things that this article talked about was how for iOS 7 they're getting away from things like that, where you have an app that looks like a desk planner. So instead
Okay.
Yeah. So yeah. Instead of it looking like a piece of paper and pencil and a circle around something that was done with a marker, it's trying to look more computer like instead of looking like something it shouldn't be.
I think that makes sense. I think nobody asked my opinion, but here we go. Skeuomorphism, I think, might make sense if you need to take an existing object and digitize it, and people need to be able to use the metaphor in order to understand how to use it correctly, right?
Yes.
But once people get sufficiently comfortable working with your tool, the importance of skeuomorphism, I have to imagine, goes down, right? Because you can kind of reteach people over time how to use the product in a more kind of more interesting way that's not bound to its rendering in the real world, right? I look at like my calendar app, if you look at your Zimbra calendar or really any other calendar app, you can do so many more things with that calendar app. And if I'm a programmer, I'm developing the interface, if I had to make that calendar behave as if it were a desktop planner, a real desktop planner, it would be a lot less useful, right?
Like maybe it's good for a stepping stone, mm-hmm. where think about changing your dialer on your phone to push button to a rotary phone to get people comfortable, and it's actually a step backwards. So if you could actually use newer design techniques that are optimized for the way people should be doing things today that, that may actually be a good thing.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. Skeuomorphism. Skeuomorphism. All right, got it. And we got it. And Dave, I guess this is our final item. And we saved the best for last because both of us are really excited about this. Dave, we started a jihad, haven't we?
Yes, we have.
This This is year zero under the new meeting jihad, the new meeting regime. We are not going to tolerate any meetings without agendas, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
What else are we going to demand for meetings?
Action items.
Action items. We need action items in our meetings. Meetings with clear edges, right? They're going to have a beginning time and an end time.
And a start time.
And a start time. With the possible exception of this podcast, which seems to slide around a lot on Fridays. But I think
with no end time.
And no end time. That's right. So we found Merlin Mann, who's a productivity maven, kind of micro celebrity in the productivity world, has a talk that he gave at Twitter. And the video for this is included in the show notes. And Dave, I don't know about you, but I'm actually treating this as my Bible for the time being.
Yeah. It's I know when we were talking about that, and you said that you were going to look at it a second time and take notes.
Yes, and in fact, I have. I actually have how many? I have 4,000 words of notes based on this time. Yeah. So the video is full of good advice. Some of it is, in fact, very little of it is obvious. He is not your typical kind of productivity guru. He has a great way of understanding the problem and also understanding how you could bring about an effective solution. So I'm all about effective meetings. And I think everyone deserves it. They should start that again. Anyway, I'm a huge fan of this talk, and I think everyone owes it to themselves to watch this video and try and improve the quality of the meetings in their everyday lives.
Yeah, and you'll probably hold people accountable.
I'll be downright Prussian about it. How about that?
Yeah.
Man, I'm going to get letters about the German thing. Talk about Germans and then Prussians. I might be in trouble. So, Dave, if people did want to complain about my bad talking the Teutonic peoples, where would they go to do that?
Yeah, or if they wanted to suggest other peoples to for you to pick on instead.
That's right.
They should go to dgshow.org. So D is in Dave, G is in Gunner, show.org.
That's awesome. And hit Dave or I up on the Twitters. Let us know if you see any news you want us to talk about or any discussion topics. The call is still open for people to interview at the Red Hat Summit in June. So don't forget to, if you got any suggestions there, don't forget to let us know. And otherwise, we will see you guys next week.
Yep. See you guys. Thanks.